Boa noite, nós estamos aqui com a Amy Hollowell Sensei. Para os que já a conhecem, não será uma novidade. A Sensei Amy Hollowell vive em Paris e ensina em Paris há vários anos. Este ensinamento, esta tradição zen, vem da linhagem do Maizumi Roshi, que foi um dos primeiros mestres japoneses que foi para os Estados Unidos, que por sua vez deu a transmissão a várias pessoas, e daí até chegar à Sensei Amy Hollowell, que recebeu por sua vez a transmissão de uma Roshi francesa que vive em Paris, que é Catherine Guénot-Pagès. Mas não vou dizer, acho que vieram cá para ouvi-la e pronto. Obrigado por terem vindo.
Thank you. Well, now you know everything. I'm speaking English. I can't speak Portuguese, I'm sorry. If you have difficulty understanding, please ask. Several people can translate if you need something. I will try to speak slowly, clearly. Sometimes I forget. And I would be interested to hear any questions or comments that you have at any point while I'm speaking. So it's a much more vibrant, dynamic process if you participate, if you want to. I think Tomas said that I'm a member of a Zen lineage. Zen maybe doesn't mean anything to you. Maybe you have some ideas about it. Those ideas are fine. However, that's not what it is. And my ideas about it are not what it is either. And I have many more ideas than you do, I'm sure. I gave a title to this conference tonight. I asked in the car if someone could remind me what it was. I think it's twirling a flower, yeah? The essential teaching of Zen, yeah? Okay. And I don't know how that was translated. I'd kind of like to hear what it is in Portuguese, if anyone knows. No one knows. It wasn't translated. Okay. And the essential teaching of Zen? That was not translated?
Yes, it was. Yeah.
Okay. Similar.
Yeah.
Very similar.
Okay. Well, the essential teaching of Zen is always the same, so that's appropriate that it's similar, and it's never the same, so that also is similar. I chose that title because it's one of the basic stories that we tell in Zen, and we tell a lot of stories. It's a teaching that is, we say, outside of the sutras, the scriptures, the writings. We say that the transmission in Zen, the transmission of the teaching, what is taught, is outside of that. And yet we tell stories all the time. And one of the stories, one of the founding stories, has to do with a flower being turned. And that's why I chose the title. I didn't know what kind of group this would be tonight, and I still don't. There are some people I know. but others I don't, and I don't know how familiar you are with meditation or the jargon of Buddhism, Zen, any of these things that float in the popular culture. So I'm starting with a very simple story. The story goes that the person whom we refer to as the Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, he was a historic man. He actually existed. There's proof of this. One day he arrived to speak before a gathering of people, something like this. Although it was on a mountain, I actually read something, a contemporary teacher who visited this place, and it's not really a mountain at all, it's a small hill. but in the story, it's a mountain. And there's probably a large group of people. I don't know how many. I think of it as being very big. And sometimes when I hear this story, I think of that scene from Monty Python. I don't know if anyone, where Christ is speaking and the people in the distant, far distance, and they hear it and they think, what did he say? The kingdom of God will belong to the cheesemakers, or whatever it was. So I imagine the scene something like this. And so the Buddha arrives before this assembly. This man arrives before the assembly. And he holds up a flower. He turns a flower. No one says anything. No one does anything. Except one person who has gone down in history. His name is Mahakashyapa. Who smiled. And at that moment, we say that was the first transmission, the first Zen transmission. And this is one of our sacred stories in Zen lineages, although it's probably a story that never happened. Historically, it's probably not true. That takes nothing away from the meaning, the essential fact, I would say, of the teaching. This is what I wanted to tell you tonight. I usually don't do this, but I brought a text because there's a very specific thing that the Buddha supposedly says when he makes this transmission, when he twirls the flower and Mahakashyapa smiles. He said, I have the all-pervading true Dharma, incomparable Nirvana. This sounds really extraordinary, doesn't it? Exquisite teaching of formless form. It does not rely on letters, and is transmitted outside scriptures. I now hand it to Mahakasha. I only read this because I can't remember it, so I can't tell you he said this amazing thing. It doesn't sound the same as hearing it, what he said. I have the all-pervading true Dharma, incomparable Nirvana, exquisite teachings of formless form. A lot of words that don't say anything. And that say just this. All they say is that. He goes on to say, this incomparable, exquisite teaching doesn't rely on letters, meaning no words. It's transmitted outside of these so-called sacred texts. And now I'm handing it to Mahakashyapa. Although he didn't hand the flower to Mahakashyapa. The story says he just twirled it and Mahakashyapa smiled. It says he broke into a smile, actually. It doesn't say he smiled. In some translations it says he cracked a smile. I don't know if you have expressions in Portuguese similar to that. But this notion of breaking or cracking into a smile. Basically, what this story is telling us is that there is no teaching, there is no method. And everything is the teaching. Everything is the method. Everything is a valid tool for awakening. And awakening just means to see the flower and smile. To see things as they are. That's what awakening means. That's what this exquisite teaching of incomparable nirvana is. This all-pervading true Dharma is just this. Right now, here and now. The problem is that the notion of it, or just this, becomes very quickly a letter, a word, a concept, an idea, a doctrine, a church, a tradition. We start wearing things like this and bowing and chanting and studying texts and going on retreats and lighting incense. And there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, it's very helpful sometimes. The problem is when we become attached to that and we believe that that's what the all-pervading true Dharma, incomparable nirvana, exquisite teaching of formless form is. Formless form sounds funny. A form that has no form. Forms are the concrete world of difference, diversity. So we have men and we have women. We have French people and Portuguese people. We have night and day, light, darkness, tall people, short people, fast airplanes, slow bicycles. Differences. Flowers, trees, fish, chestnuts. Chestnuts that are cooked, chestnuts that aren't cooked. Vast. Innumerable, the forms. Well, this exquisite teaching of formless form is simply that these forms are not what we think they are. And the principal form that is not what we think it is this. We have this idea about this form. This is me. I reduce myself to this. I limit myself to this. And then I limit the other to that. So there's this and there's that. And he has his space and I have mine. And from that, innumerable sufferings emerge from that very basic me. We eventually come to invading countries, same people who have different color skin or different eyes or different way of speaking than I do are not good. If you don't have the correct papers, you can't enter here, you can't work here. If your mother belonged to some sect, then you are not acceptable. If your grandmother, if your ancestors way back did, then you're not acceptable. Any number of distinctions that we become fixed upon, and continue limiting the experience of this incomparable nirvana to these tiny forms that we've put things into. But the exquisite teaching of formless form does not rely on anything. Meaning, this form is not limited. If we tried to take this form apart, we would eventually, we could say this is an arm, and this is the left arm, right arm, feet, hair. We could take the parts apart, and then take the part apart, and find muscle, blood, bone, inside the bone, the marrow, and then break each of those elements down even more, and we would come to cells. Eventually we would come to the atom. I don't know, I'm not a biologist, but we would reduce it and keep reducing it and reducing it and reducing it. And what would we find? If we reduced the cup in the same way, the elements, what would we come to? Nothing is solid, is basically what we would come to. Everything is changing all the time. And nothing is made of a solid element that is unrelated to other solid elements. Everything is related. Everything is working together. We are all breathing the same air. We're breathing the same air here that they are breathing in Paris. We're under the same sky. This is the exquisite teaching of formless form, which manifests as flower, which manifests as this speck here on the floor, which manifests as speech, which manifests as just this moment. It's very simple, actually. The basic teaching is very simple. It's no teaching. And when it says that Zen doesn't rely on letters and is transmitted outside the scriptures, all teachings are transmitted outside all scriptures. When we say that, all we're saying is it's transmitted by experience. In fact, nothing is transmitted. And that's true of any teaching. We say we learn by experience. It's a saying we have in English. Which applies to everything. If you read something in a book, of course you learn whatever is written there. But what is written there is not the teaching. You are the teaching. And you are the teacher. Of course, there are teachers. I'm sitting here and I'm talking to you. I was recognized by my teacher as a teacher. And she was recognized by her teacher as a teacher. And all the way back, 83 generations to this first story. This is the Zen story. That from teacher to student, from teacher to student, that's how it's transmitted. Because the experience is the same, and all it is a recognition of that. The experience of this very moment, if we are not approaching it with our ideas, our experience right now, at this very moment, of the blue blanket is the same as Mahakashapa's experience of the flower. And that is the transmission. That is what is transmitted. That's the teaching that's outside the scriptures. That's the all-pervading true dharma, incomparable nirvana, exquisite teaching of formless form. That's the secret. We often hear this story and we think, oh, this is amazing secret story. There's some secret thing going on here. Something esoteric between these two that Mahakasha smiled. And the Buddha recognized him. But it's not. It's the most obvious thing in the world. But usually we're not paying any attention. It's the most sane, simple experience of life. But usually we're involved in this crazy, insane, complicated thing that we make life into. When really it's just this flower. When we were trying to light the incense there, we had kind of a similar type thing. Couldn't figure out how to work this mechanical flame. No matches in the kitchen. I didn't know. And then suddenly there, behind the statue, hidden secretly, was a blue lighter. And this inconceivably exquisite, all-pervading, true dharma, nirvana, formless form, is not even as hidden as that blue lighter behind the statue. It's even more obvious. But we're looking in the wrong place. We're looking behind the statue, when in fact it's right there in front. Or we're looking at the statue, and we're involved in what that statue represents, or who made the statue, or where it came from, or what it is made out of, or how much it cost, or comparing it with another statue we have that we like better, or we prefer the Burmese version instead of the Chinese version. The Chinese guys are always kind of fat, and the Burmese ones are very elegant. The Tibetan ones are very exotic, with different colors and faces and forms. And we miss the point. We miss what's right there in front of us. It's not about the statue. Anything is valid. Anything can be that statue. The statue is just a reminder. Just something we use to remind us. Ah, yes. The all-pervading true Dharma. Ah, yes. The flower. Just twirling the flower. Not even twirling the flower, just ah, yes. Ah, yes. And maybe not even, ah, yes. There are hundreds of techniques. There are any number of schools. Traditions. There are as many paths as there are seekers. And that each of those paths is valid. Like I said, anything is a valid tool, way. We say there's a Sanskrit word, upaya, which means skillful means. Everything is a skillful means. A skillful means to awakening, as I said. Because we can approach this from a negative aspect perspective or a positive perspective. And the negative aspect would be, there is no teaching, there is no path, there is nothing to get, there is nothing to be transmitted. And the positive, the affirmative perspective would be, everything is it. Everything is teaching. Everything is the way. And then, of course, what the person we call the Buddha taught was the middle way, which is not really the middle. It's not. It's the middle in the sense that it includes both. So it includes the nothing and it includes the everything. It's nothing and everything. And that is what is manifesting at every moment. Nothing and everything. I'm taking it apart and describing and putting words to it in an attempt to open perspectives, to kind of like opening the windows in a room. But my words, what I'm saying, is not the point. Again, I'm repeating myself over and over again, and I always say the same thing every time. If you've ever been to these talks that I've given before, I've said the same thing every time. Because there's nothing else to say. Because this is what it is. So at the heart of the, you know, I said this is the essential teaching of Zen, because this is really the heart of the Zen practice. And the way that it is put into practice is through a sitting practice, meditation, what is popularly called meditation, but it's not really meditating on something. It's just sitting. Just sitting with what is. And at the center of that practice is the relationship between student and teacher. When we talk about the transmission, that's what we're talking about. At the same time, nothing is transmitted. So what's transmitted is non-transmission, we can say. Zen has this reputation for saying things like that, for using language in that way. But it's the truth. In the sense that words are not what we think they are. We become very attached to the meaning of a word. And when we say transmit, immediately we think, something is transferred from here to there. There's a transmission of it. Which, okay, that's the definition of the word. Collectively, we've agreed that's what that word means. Language is always unsatisfactory. Trying to describe an experience of things as they are. Because things as they are not limited to words. So in Zen, we use language in such a way to strip it of its usual context. And that's why it always sounds strange when we say things like that. What is transmitted is non-transmission. The goal is no goal. Things like this that you hear. A meditation practice that I give students sometimes is to, while they're sitting, be aware of whatever arises. It might be a sound, a feeling, a thought. And when they become aware of this, an odor it could be, when they become aware of it, they try to give it a word, put a word on it, identify it, in a language that they don't speak, that they don't know. So, I could do it with Portuguese. I don't speak Portuguese. So I could sit here and identify things in Portuguese. Very specifically. But because I don't know that language, what happens is, first of all, I will become aware of it and probably think of the word in English, because that, or maybe French. I think in both most of the time. But then in order to translate it, I have to open the space around whatever it is and allow the other word to emerge in the other language. I have to take away my idea of the English word and let the other word emerge. But because it's a language I don't know, no specific word will emerge. And I have a better possibility of experiencing whatever it is that's arising just as it is, without any descriptions of its exterior, shall we say. I have a better chance of just experiencing it as it is, without labeling it. Because I can't. I don't speak that language. And that's the truth about every phenomenon that arises. I don't speak that language. It's not speakable. The language of things as they are is not speakable. When we speak of it in these words that I'm speaking now, I'm not speaking the language of things as they are. But that's the language we have to speak to talk about things as they are. So that's the essential teaching of Zen. Sometimes people hear this and they say, well, why did only Mahakashapa smile? Doesn't matter. Start from the principle that the story is not even true. So we can tell whatever we want about it. What is true is the essential teaching and the experience of this transmission. That is true. And if someone has had that experience, then they will tell a story like this. Because they can't tell any other kind of story about it. It has to be a story like this because you can't tell it any other way. Maybe it is true. Who knows? It is true that there was these people who existed and that there was this place where the Buddha used to go and give his talks. However, the first time that this story appeared in the research that people have done was in China, maybe about the 5th or 6th century. And that was a long time after the Buddha was alive and functioning in India. So chances are it didn't really happen like that. However, the tracing back from one student to teacher, from student to teacher to student to teacher, can be traced back to that era between those two. Mahakashapa was considered the Buddha's one of his most important students, in the sense that he was one of the first and one of the most loyal, and was considered to be very advanced in his practice and his realization. And then he transmitted to someone else, who transmitted to someone else, and on and on. And they all had a transmission like that. So, do you have any questions about that? Or does that resonate in any way? Or
I was thinking, from what I'm hearing, from what I can understand, is it possible for someone simple, like a farmer or a fisherman in their background alone, to feel, even for a moment, Zen?
Yes.
Without any teachings, without...
Yes. Yes. There is another story about someone just like that.
Yeah.
Exactly. Which is also one of the best loved Zen stories for that very reason. And myself, I always liked that story because I identified very much with the central character. Not that I'm a farmer, illiterate, or like that person, but I had no special training, no experience in this kind of tradition, and so I identified very much with him. Yeah, because the thing is, we all are, let's say, Buddhas. Buddha means awakened one. We all are that, but we don't realize it. And it doesn't require any special skills to realize it.
Yeah, like you were saying, if the teaching is everywhere, so everyone can have access to it.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And I can testify to that from personal experience, having seen many, many, many people in this practice, and children, old people, young people, different nationalities, languages. Yeah. It's the same for any tradition, however. You know, a Christian would tell you the same thing. Christ's message was the same. We lose sight of that often when we become caught up in the forms, however, and hierarchies and requirements. There are no requirements.
It's a formless form.
Mm-hmm.
So
without them, so that's right. And initially, when the Buddha himself, after having realized this, after a lot of hard work, seeing the star, and him seeing the morning star, that was his flower that he saw, the equivalent of the flower for him. And seeing suddenly how wonderful everyone and everything as it is it. How wonderful. And his realization was that, of course, everyone potentially could realize this, but that they had to realize it themselves. And that no words, no teaching could do that for them. So he initially thought he would not say a word, and that he would just go off by himself and enjoy this. However, he didn't. He thought about his friends, his old comrades who he had sat with, who he had attempted to awaken with in a different way. And he went to them to see how they were doing. He thought of them sitting there in the forest and had feeling for them, felt compassion for them with their struggle. And went to see them, and that is when he began his teaching. And for the next 40 years, he kept talking. I'm saying this in response to the comment, yes, there there are ways, there is a path, there are techniques, there are teachings. But that's not what's taught. That's where it becomes... There, we even have a story in Zen that says there are no teachers of Zen. And it's a teacher of Zen who's saying that. It's a Zen master who's saying it. Our mind, however, functions in such a way that when we say there is no path, immediately we will say there is a path. Or if we say there is a path, we will say there isn't a path. We always think in dualities. Our general way of functioning is in dualities. If it's not white, then it's black. And as I said earlier, the Buddha pointed out the middle way, which is holding up the flower. The flower, that's a teaching. And it's not a teaching either. It's just a flower. Now, I'm not seeking to confuse you. I'm not seeking to enlighten you either. I'm not. Did that make a noise? No.
No.
I'm just sitting here and telling you about my experience, and as a result of that experience, there was only one thing for me to do, which is to sit here and tell you that. When Mahakashapa smiles upon seeing the flower, he knows there's only one thing for him to do. He goes on, and as the Buddha famously said to his, in one of the so-called scriptures that the teaching is not in, he says, be a light unto yourself. His students, his disciples are saying, after you die, what will we do? This is the eternal question for all students, disciples. They said the same thing to Christ. St. Francis of Assisi, always. He said, what should we do? What should we do? And he said, be a light unto yourself. The answer is in you. You are the answer. You are the lamp. And Mahakashapa knows that there is only one thing for him to do, be a light unto himself and show that flower to another. And yet, he's not really doing anything. So, so that is one of the basic teachings of Zen. This teaching, the form of it changes all the time, as forms change all the time. So if a Japanese monk in a monastery in Kyoto were to be talking about this story, it would look and feel very different, probably. The setting would be different. The words he used would be different. If an American teacher in California were talking about this, it would be different as well. It would look different, feel different. If I were speaking in Portuguese, it would be different. If I talk about this tomorrow, it will be different. It's always changing. The form is always changing, but the essence does not change. And that's why this teaching is still alive now, 2,500 years after the Buddha first twirled this flower. Okay. Questions? Another opportunity to speak?
I think every tradition has their own maps of showing the way to enlightenment. What do you think are the maps of Zen?
Well, this is one of them, this story. Maps in the sense of...
indicating the way.
Yeah. And so Zen doesn't have a lot of them, apart from the story tradition of telling stories and very basic forms. That's speaking just in a strict sense of maps. At the same time, Zen repeats over and over and over again that everything is a map. Everything is a teaching. So in that sense, the universe is a map for the Zen teaching. But in terms of very specific traditional maps, the stories, and very basic forms of sitting. Not very complicated. Not complex. Is that what you meant?
Yeah, kind of.
Or something more specific?
We are human beings, so we have different abilities to sense, like smelling, tasting, seeing, hearing, and thinking as well. And I wanted to know if related to Zen, if what we are trying to do is just and break a little bit of the way that we perceive and we use these senses to imagine what we think it's reality and it isn't, because we are taking like perceptions and experience that we have during our life, and we think those are the reality, those are truth.
Mm.
And most of the time it's just a singularity of that experience, and we perceive as the whole reality.
Mm.
So it's Zen going or trying us, testing us against what you think it's really true, or are we playing with our perceptions, or maybe I was not very clear?
No, I think I understand. Zen doesn't really, I would say, the rather than to focus on individual senses or to map it out in that way, let's say, to stay with the metaphor of the map. In Zen practice, we just say, sit down with whatever is here and experience it, whatever it is. Include it. Include it in your experience of the moment. Instead of what we usually do, is we include certain things and we reject others. So the basic the basic instruction would be to just include it all, whatever it is. And because ultimately, what if you're saying what are we trying for? I think you said something like that, or what are we trying to do, or what are we trying to get at? It's to be here now. And to fully be here now means to not be separate from whatever it is. And so our task becomes to include it so that we're closing the gap between myself and myself, in fact. Closing the gap so that I experience things directly just as they are. Primarily me. That's first of all me. So ultimately the question becomes, who am I? And that's the big question.
Mm-hmm. I was paying attention, and it seems the example of the map is the whole universe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I thought, okay, I ask someone, give me a map, and they say, okay, here's the map of the universe, so where do I go? And they say, you have all the universe, I think I would sit down too. Where do I go? It's infinite, and I'm so small I can walk all the universe, so I will stay here. And I think it's a little bit, I feel, like Zen getting the other idea of the word. It's like creating, avoiding the thought, and not the hurry to... the words connect to other thoughts, to the memories. We associate the words. Mm-hmm. It means something for us always. Sweet means the candy that I ate yesterday, the things that I like. And bitter means something that I don't like. So if I say this is sweet, these are all the memories I have before. And trying to do that of the word, thinking in another language, I think that creates that gap. It's just that. Yeah, yeah, it's just that, I think. It's hard to describe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I feel that that thing of the whole universe as a map creates a little bit that feeling too, of it's everything. It's difficult to say. It's simply, I don't know. That's, you see it, the universe is here, and I am in the universe,
right.
So where can I go?
That's right.
Yeah, the universe is not on the other side.
Exactly. That's what I often say to people, that, there's good news and bad news. The universe is here right now, and there's no way out. That's the good news and the bad news. There's nowhere else to go. You're already here. You're already here, and you're already it. You don't have to be someone else. There's nothing to get. You have everything. It's all here right now. And that's the good news and the bad news. Depends how you look at it, right? If we are attached to an idea of getting something somewhere else, becoming someone different, going somewhere else, getting away from here, then that's bad news, right? The universe is here right now. But this is I'm being playful because, in fact, it's great news. It's our liberation.
But the sense of insatisfaction of this, of whatever we are experiencing, maybe it's because we are not totally experiencing.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah, we have a limited experience, and therefore something is missing, and we're not satisfied.
Do you think that through Zazen we achieve this kind of feeling or knowledge? Sitting in Zazen is really a very important tool or a way to be able to see things better? Or
well, here again we have the good news and the bad news. I hesitate often to respond to that kind of question because no, we don't get anything from sitting. No. However, and this is an example I use regularly, it's as if this were a jar of dirty water. If I'm shaking it up like I usually do in my life, the water will be cloudy. If I put it down and stop moving it around and shaking it up, it will settle and the water will become clear. This is a metaphor that only goes so far, but it speaks to this question of, yes, something settles when we sit. Something clarifies. Because we allow things to be just as they are, without trying to organize them, without trying to eliminate them or grasp them, our usual functioning in the world is to push things away that we don't like and hang on to things that we do like. I'm simplifying it, but that's the basic way of functioning. Of course, we can't hold on to anything. What we want to keep won't stay, and what we want to get rid of won't go away in the way that we want it to go away. So it's true, by sitting, we allow things to be, that activity that's shaking up of the mind is not happening so much, or we become more aware of it, and that light of the awareness takes away its power. The grasping, the rejecting, the activity no longer has the same power once we've shown the light of awareness on it. So that, in that sense, yes, there is something to be said for sitting. However, we don't get anything, and there's nothing to be obtained because we already have everything. And that's what's obtained, is that realization. Like I said, what's transmitted is non-transmission. Is that what you meant? Or?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. But at the same time, I think as the farmer, for example, and he might get, it's not a question of getting something, you know? But he might get the same clarity just by sitting.
Absolutely, yeah.
The ground, absolutely. Not sitting in a Zen position,
that's right.
Zazen position. It's more or less that thing, we have to sit in this way, or we just sit and feel things.
And yet there is a difference between walking along a country road and sitting under a tree and then having a drink of water, or sitting formally in a posture that we've decided we have this intention of this. There's a difference. And that's where we come back to, there is a way, there are techniques. There's a difference, and it's important to recognize the differences. When we sit in Zen, we have different images that we use to describe the attention that we are seeking in this posture. And one of them is, it's the equivalent of having a spoon full of burning oil and trying to cross the room with a row of people with swords drawn. And if you drop one drop of that oil, the swords come down on you. You have this kind of awareness, this kind of attention to the moment when you're sitting. This is the ideal. We have the Japanese word for just sitting is shikan taza. And I don't speak Japanese, but I've been taught some of the Japanese words, and apparently shik is to sit, apparently, and taza is just, so just sitting, shik taza. But if you add shiken taza, this shiken is something different. It's not just sitting, it's just sitting! It's la, this, right here. It's that shook everybody up, right? Because that's what it is. It's here. It's not this kind of just sitting. And yet it is, as well. But with this attention of just sitting. Sometimes we think of it as being some sort of samurai thing. It's not. It's not about violence. It's not about aggression. It's about just being here totally. Nothing outside. Direct presence.
But it also doesn't mean it is pleasure always.
Oh no.
Many days you sit and it's a hell of a day just for being sitting. You don't want to be with yourself a single minute. You're fed up with you. So it doesn't mean it's good.
No, it's not about good or bad.
Yes.
It's not about good or bad. It's not about liking or disliking. It's being present beyond that, maybe. But not beyond in the sense of somewhere else. Acknowledging the good and the bad and the liking and disliking and being present with that, with all of it. So sometimes, you know, actually the last time I was here in Portugal in a retreat, someone in the introduction in the beginning, at the beginning of the retreat, she had never done any meditation before, and I explained how to do it, and there were other people too, and then I was asking people why they came, and she said, well, it sounded like a really good idea, and I told myself that if I didn't like it, I could leave. And I said, that's true. I did not say to her, this isn't about liking or disliking this practice. And on the second day, she left. Since then, I have thought to myself many times, maybe I should have said to her that first night, this is not about disliking and liking. I don't know what would have happened differently, but the thought comes to me regularly. And this is a thought that comes from my what I call my dualistic mind of wanting a result. Not that I particularly thought that woman should stay, but because I have had this experience and I know how that has had, what effect that has had on my life and on life of many other people that I've seen also have this experience, I have a preference. I'm a human being. I have to let go of that preference. And I have to just let things be as they are. And I do, most of the time. Well, maybe not most of the time. That's not a fair assessment. I do, sometimes, I'd say. So, it's true. There are moments when you don't like it at all, and there are moments when you really like it. And both of those are passing, impermanent. And if you wanted it to stay bad, it won't. It won't stay bad. And if you want it to stay good, it won't. I mean, if you think about just the flower, a flower is a really fine example because we watch it die before our eyes. We see the flowers whoosh, die. And actually, although we don't think about it, it's part of why we appreciate flowers so much, is because we know that. We know how fleeting that blossom is. The same thing is true for everything, for this moment, for each one of us. We are all dying. We are all close to death every moment. And we are all totally alive at this moment. Like that flower. The flower is a reminder of that. Okay. Well, I thank you very much. I thank Sagara, who I saw walking the door. Thank you for your hospitality. And if you have questions, if you want more information about my practice here, I'm not sure who you should ask, you or you two or Isabel, I don't know, who's answering questions, I don't know. We're starting a retreat tomorrow. And I come a few times a year here to Portugal and do retreats, and usually a conference or something somewhere. That's it. And we're also on the web, and you can find us if you want to. But they can also tell you something if you want to know, I think. Okay. Thank you.